Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast. In this episode, we talk about the new forum at Hardware Asylum, video card testing, and ultra-wide screen monitors. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today, I have Darren McKinney. Darren, in the interest of continual improvement, I've added a new feature back to Hardware Asylum.
Oh, that sounds exciting. Back to the asylum. What are we doing?
We're adding a web forum.
Oh, fantastic. Now, we had a forum before, some of our older listeners may remember.
Yeah, we had the Ninja Lane message forum, and this was one of the oldest features of Ninja Lane.
I know you haven't always been fond of forums, so what brings the forum back?
When I launched Hardware Asylum several years ago, I decided that social media was going to be the conversation vehicle for all of our articles and podcasts and stuff like that.
So by social media, you're talking Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat and all that kind of stuff?
Yes, yes.
And how's that working?
Not so well. Unfortunately, with Facebook, they are taking every post and really kind of converting it into an ad. So if you pay more money, then your post goes out to more people, even though you might have 1,500 people that want to get more information on you.
I have noticed frequently people say, hey, did you see my post? And it has been buried in my feed.
Yeah, or doesn't even show up at all.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's no good.
I mean, I might post a review, for instance, and it will go out to maybe 2% of the people that are liking the page, which makes it very difficult for new people to come in and like the page and see what's going on and get interactive.
Yeah, and we do like to interact with our readers and our viewers.
So when PHPBB was what started the Ninja Lane message form. I was launched with version 2 and upgraded to version 3, but I had a continual problem of just blatant spam.
Yeah, and that's unavoidable in a lot of places. I mean, especially the come find a job or check out my pictures.
I had a problem with UK kitchen remodelers or something like that.
I wonder how we got on that list.
I have no idea. I mean, it's just very random and it's a bot. And it's one of those things where a human will get paid to go out and register for a forum. And then that username will go into the bot registry. And once
very
you're logged
clever.
In, then they'll do this automated spam stuff. Now, PHPBB, that's the way it goes. Version 3.1 introduced a few new features that I really like. And one of them is a new user registration, which should eliminate most of the spam. So when a new user comes in there and they make a post, it goes into a moderation queue. And until a specified number of posts have been approved by the moderator, they continually stay in that queue.
Oh, so you have to pay your dues of sorts.
Yeah, pretty much. It just like in some of the larger forums where you have to have like 200 posts before you can post in the classified ad section. So it's more of a, you know, prove that you are a legitimate person and we will allow you to continually post. So I'm testing the waters with that new feature and hopefully it will keep the spam down and harness and foster a good community.
Now, you can use a forum in a lot of different ways. What are you thinking for uses for the forum? I mean, what kind of topics can we look forward to?
There's a lot of things I have planned for the forum. The first one is obviously to promote discussions on the podcast and articles and the builds. So those are going to be cross-posted, and that's kind of an automated thing that I can handle within the CMS.
Right. I want to give a chance to get some real-time or near real-time feedback. That's nice.
Yeah, people can flame me or you know, say, hey, that's an awesome overclock. I did this, and, you know, and kind of brag. Another feature that I want to build is what I call the Learning Center. And in an attempt to, you know, become a Reddit reader, I'm more of a lurker, I should say. I go and troll the r/hardware subreddit.
Ah, yeah.
You get a lot of people posting about reviews and you get a lot of just dumb questions. One of them that I see all the time is like, how good is my overclock? Or is my CPU too hot? So I go and read through some of the comments and the ones that are really active at the top are usually terribly incorrect.
Oh, no. Well, there's a lot of misinformation out there, and a lot of us armchair overclockers, too.
Right. And the misinformation, I think, is what is really holding the computer hobby back. Admittedly, a lot of people don't really read reviews anymore. They don't care about that so much since they can go down and like buy a Dell or buy a Surface. But there's a lot of people that want to know this stuff. And Darren and I, we've been doing this for a long time. We know some things and we just kind of think that it's common knowledge. But for a person just getting into it, like, is my heatsink any good? Or is my heatsink defective? There's no way that a new user is going to know that. So in the Learning Center, I'm going to take some of these, what I consider to be really dumb, common knowledge sort of questions that people have, and answer them in such a way that it's very technical and very detailed, but also dumbed down to the point where somebody could read it and get the answer they need and then move on.
Well, and in the forum format, it gives you the opportunity for a lively discussion.
Mm-hmm. So I think the forum is going to be a good vehicle for that, and that hopefully it can be not just me posting questions, but people can come to the forum and say, hey, I found out that this fan is better than this fan. Here's my testing.
Well, one thing I've noticed about our readers and listeners is there's a lot of knowledge out there, enthusiast level knowledge and high-end build knowledge. And I know if they're anything like I am, there's probably always somebody asking for their advice about something build related or computer related. And this would be a good opportunity for them to chime in just when they have time.
Exactly. And obviously there's some other forum threads in there, like ones dedicated to video cards and motherboards and cooling. We'll have a healthy overclocking section. So hopefully we can get some of the old people that used to post in the Ninja Lane message forum about their overclocking adventures and what they did with liquid nitrogen this last weekend. And yeah, it's just kind of, I want to build it from there. So as more people get involved and it starts to grow, then we can build it.
Well, it's nice to see the community will have a hand in the direction that it'll grow too. So we can see what's successful and we can grow that forum together. So how do folks get to this forum?
You go to hardwareasylum.com and the top navigation there is forums. You can click on that and go directly to it. Or if you're more of a typist URL person, hardwareasylum.com/forums.
And of course, don't forget to register. Let us know who you are so that we can get you through that renewal process and get you involved in the discussion. So hopefully we'll see you out there.
Darren, as you know, we review hardware here at Hardware Asylum.
Well, of course we do.
And the hardware that we look at is usually enthusiast grade, so that we're looking at the upper high end, sometimes hard to get stuff.
Well, absolutely. In fact, we pride ourselves in some of the equipment we do review and the fact that we don't just review it. We also stick it, when applicable, of course, on the LN2 or the water cooling or the phase.
Yes. One such item that I have been lucky enough to get since the 780 Ti days is the 980 Ti Classified.
And we've talked about that in a previous podcast, and I honestly can't say enough good about it. So tell me, where are you headed?
Well, when the review went live, EVGA went and reposted it on their Facebook stream.
That's very nice of them.
Yeah, I get a lot of traffic from that. Well, I also like to kind of check out some of the comments because some people don't necessarily comment on the Hardware Asylum thread so much. It's mostly like, you know, a scatter chart. So there's more people on the EVGA one. So,
well, what's important is we're always looking to see how our reviews can be improved and how they're being taken by the community as an effort to better ourselves.
Exactly. So some of the comments that I noticed was, a couple of people got it. They said, hey, well, they read the review. They realized that I called it out saying, okay, it is designed for enthusiast level overclocking. The Maxwell chip is somewhat limited in what it can do on air. So to get the most from the cards, you need to put it under chilled water, liquid nitrogen, something like that.
And that sounds really familiar. I think we talked about that in the podcast too. In fact, the way that the processor on that card is binned is actually not as high quality as it could be as for, say, a superclocked air-cooled processor, because that's not its intention.
No, not so much. And we also have to consider that the 980 Ti Kingpin Edition was being launched at around the same time. And EVGA is charging a price premium for the very high ASIC cards. So the ones that are in the 90s are selling for like $1,000.
Yeah. So let me step back. Now, we know that every manufacturer tiers their hardware. So you got kind of entry level, mid, and high. And that's where we have reference cards and such. So can you just refresh my memory on the hierarchy of cards? We know the Kingpin Edition is the top dog.
Right. Within the EVGA framework, we have the Kingpin Edition, which is the card designed for liquid nitrogen overclocking. So we have the same VRM that's on the classified, but it has more power connections in there, some reworked memory stuff, different lights. It's more or less designed to be run in one particular manner to set records.
And of course, you're going to pay a premium for that, but it is more of a niche product.
Right. The step down from that is the classified edition. Now, in the past, back when the 780 and 780 Ti days, the classified was really the top dog. That was before the Kingpin edition came out.
And of course, people would take those apart and mod them in an effort to replicate what the Kingpin does now out of the box.
Correct. So things are kind of changing within EVGA. The classified edition was the top dog. Now they have the special LN2 edition. And with the changing of the overclock of the chip, the regular classified kind of has a less...
It's become kind of a high-end gaming card now, which is what I like about it. But it's not really the one you're going to pick if you're going to be tearing it apart and putting the phase or whatever on it.
Definitely. And out of the box, obviously the classified edition has the highest clock. It's higher clock than the super clock edition. Obviously, you can overclock the super clock edition, you know. So there's obviously a limit. And some of the comments on the EVGA Facebook page were talking to that. They were saying, okay, well, me, the reviewer mentioned that you're not going to get much out of it unless you use the card the way it was intended.
Right, which is aftermarket cooling.
Exactly. There was a few other comments in there that kind of got me thinking. One person was commenting on how I didn't use modern games.
Okay. So what did they pick as a modern game that we missed?
Battlefield 4.
Wait a minute. I play Battlefield 4, and it's at end of life.
Pretty much, yeah. And it's not that demanding in terms of hardware. Obviously, yes, it does support some AMD features that are not going to be present on the NVIDIA card
anyway. Well, you have draw distance and detail and some physics. I mean, you got some boxes to check.
Yeah, you got a few, but it's not a modern game, so to speak. But to that point, probably the latest game that I use in my testing is Metro Last Light. I use the latest Firestrike. Crysis 2 is in there. BioShock Infinite is in there.
Fairly new. And the new Tomb Raider I know is in there.
Yeah. And that's an AMD specific one. So that's one thing that got me thinking. It's like, okay, modern game, but then they use Battlefield 4. Another reader, commenter, I should say, was also commenting on how I didn't use a 4K monitor.
Oh, okay.
So, and that one is somewhat valid, but then I can also counterpoint that in saying, well, I'm using a 30-inch monitor, which not a lot of people have, but in terms of pixel density, it's not 4K, but it's pretty up there.
Well, and that's really about as high-end as most folks are going to have. I really feel like you want to go for a common denominator that people can associate with. And how many gamers have a 4K monitor?
Not that many.
And how many of them have the video cards, plural, that you usually need to drive that? I would think even less.
Yeah. To their point, though, the 980 Ti is a very powerful chip. It comes with a 6 meg frame buffer, so it will support larger textures and is designed to support 4K monitors. So obviously their point is valid in that I didn't use a 4K monitor, but what are you going to get from that? Oh, yay, it does 10 frames per second in Metro Last Light instead of 20 frames per second. You know, that's obviously a nice fall off, and that's going to carry on to all of the benchmarks that I use.
Well, I would think that you'd be fairly consistent. I mean, you're going to see a fairly equal ratio between our regular testing resolutions and 4K.
Obviously. And then there was also another comment about my bottom-end resolution. So,
oh, okay.
When I test video cards, I have a 30-inch monitor, so it's 25 by 16. And then I also do 19 by 10, which is 1080p. That's
probably the most common resolution available.
Yeah, it's going to be 80% of gamers and anyone using a video card. And then I also do 16 by 10, which is the next step down, basically. And that's a less common video card resolution, but I include that one for a particular reason.
Oh, okay, sure.
At the 30-inch monitor resolution, you'll see a certain frame rate. And then at 1080p, you'll see another frame rate. And a lot of times, if the game or video card is bottlenecked, you'll see that at the lower resolution.
How interesting.
So if you, like, for instance, in Crysis 2, my tests at 1080p and at 16 by 10 are usually virtually identical, and that's because the benchmark is CPU bound. So it's maxed out at that point. But then when you move up to 30, then you'll see a significant drop. In BioShock Infinite, for instance, you'll see a nice curve between 10.6 and 1080p. So at that point, there is still a lot of GPU rendering that's happening, and it's slowing the card down.
Okay, I see.
So the whole reason of including that lower resolution is so that you can see where the curve starts and see where the bottleneck could possibly be, if there happens to be one. Obviously, the way that I test video cards is different than, say, like Guru 3D or even Tech Power Up. They might test with more games, they test with more resolutions, but they test the same way that I do, where they have a canned benchmark and a canned set of resolutions and canned set of settings on the same system platform. So everything is kind of remains consistent, so they can compare the numbers.
Well, I keep coming back to the Battlefield 4, which is maybe one of my very favorite games. I've spent countless hours in that, single player and multiplayer. I can't say I've ever seen a benchmark in that particular set of suites.
There isn't one, as far as I can tell. You can turn on a frame rate overlay.
Oh, okay.
But you can also do that with fraps.
Ah, okay. So you'd have to try to come up with the same gameplay?
Yeah.
Yeah, not so easy to do, even in the single player game.
Well, and that's another thing that I like to put into my video card testing, is that we have a canned benchmark. So in BioShock Infinite, from the command line, you can start the game and then run through a benchmark, and you will see the same details, the same motions, same colors as it's going through the benchmark. So that way the numbers are identical. Same with any of the FutureMark benchmarks. They're always going to be the same, so you can compare the numbers. If you do Battlefield, or, you know, I used to use Battlefield 3, and you would start, you know, exiting one of the trucks, and then I'd walk down an alleyway, go through a firefight, and then I would stop, and then I would record the frame rate. And I'd have to do that 3 or 4 times to get a good average. And there was a good variance of like 20 to 30% between each of the runs. Whereas if I ran BioShock, I could run it twice and I would get the exact same number.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, you got real consistency there. And speaking of consistency, I noticed that you tend to use the same test build.
Yes, I have an X79 on a 3960X with 16 gigs of memory. On an ASUS motherboard. And that is the board that I pull out for all of the video card testing.
But that's not a Skylake or a Haswell E. I mean, why would you do that?
It's powerful. You know, it's got multi-cores. It also has quad-channel memory, so there's not going to be a lot of memory bottlenecks there. And it supports four-way in case I want to run more cards. At this point, it's a bit dated, but it's still average for what a lot of gamers still have.
Well, that's true. And I think that kind of goes back to your consistency comment there. It gives you an opportunity to say the baseline build is the same. So all the difference that you're seeing is from the video card.
Yeah, the video card. And sometimes drivers. But even then, the drivers aren't going to make a night and day difference. And a lot of times it's there's a driver upgrade. It's because there was a deficiency in one particular game that somebody had already pointed out. So in that one game, you're going to see an optimization of some sort. NVIDIA got reprimanded a couple of times for optimizing for FutureMark benchmarks, where, you know, if you ran an old driver, it would have like 200 frames per second. You ran the new driver, it was 400 frames per second.
Oh my gosh, that's a big deal.
And it was because of they did some tweaks to the texture memory and the way that that benchmark ran on the card. And it optimized, it made the benchmark look really, really good. And that's one reason that a lot of hardware sites don't use those benchmarks in their reviews so much, because of the optimization and the fact that NVIDIA might work better in this benchmark and it would not so much with an AMD card.
So stepping back to the video card review and the feedback, did you feel like the card scored about where you expected?
I did. Obviously, since it's a classified card, I would have expected a bit more overclocking out of it. But at this point, we are limited by the GPU and the fact that these classified cards have a really bad ASIC, whereas in the past, they would have a really good ASIC. I have a 780 that I still use that has a 96% ASIC on it.
Very nice.
Basically a golden chip. The next one was a 90 and it didn't overclock as well, but it's still really, really good. This is the first time I've ever gotten one in the 70s. And the GPU is the same as a 980 Ti superclock that I got as a reference sample.
Well, looking forward, I know with the Windows 10, there's a lot of changes going on in the software side of things. Can we anticipate a change in the testing platform anytime soon?
Yes and no. As you know, Mr. Darren here, it takes a really long time to test a video card.
Yes, it does.
I mean, I will spend a good 3 days running through all the different benchmarks and then testing an overclock and then running through them all again and then recording the numbers, looking at the charts, making sure that the numbers are what I'm expecting, or if I see something that's wildly off, trying to figure out why. So it takes a long time to do. And as you can tell in the review, I test with Windows 7, and I do that mostly because everything that I'm running runs well on that. Running Windows 10, there's a chance that these some of the benchmarks that I use that are very, very accurate may not actually run.
It makes sense, I think, to let things mature a little bit, which is a common Windows thread just in general.
Mm-hmm.
Wait for the first service pack, right?
Something like that. Well, I tried Windows 8, and there was a lot of inconsistencies there. A lot of it was background processes. So when I was waiting for the system to settle down so I could run a benchmark, I was wasting a good 30 minutes waiting for it to finish this little background thing so I could run a game and get a consistent score. And you'd be surprised at how much a background process can impact a DirectX 9 game, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
DirectX 11, not so much. But obviously, with Windows 10, we'll have DirectX 12. So some of those DX9 games are not going to be as relevant. But I'm more interested in the way that the hardware interacts, not necessarily how well the drivers are written to work against the DirectX protocol and interacts with the game and so on.
So if you had any direct feedback for those folks out there, what would you tell them?
I would say good job on calling me on some of those things. I mean, obviously, yes, I could have tested with Battlefield 4, but I don't believe adding Battlefield 4 as another benchmark would really give you that much. And, you know, the curve is going to be the same as like some of the other games. Sure, if you wanted to see like how many frames per second you would get with that particular game because that's the one you play, then obviously it's relevant. But it's only relevant to one person. The same with 4K. Obviously, I can go out and buy a 4K monitor and run those. I want to have a consistent testing platform. And if I'm testing like a 960, for instance, it may not work with 4K. And obviously, those resolutions I'm not going to be able to include in my charts. And it's going to be an inconsistency across all the tests.
Well, I think consistency is key, especially as an end consumer. You know, what I'm really looking at is, what do I have now? And how does it compare to what I'm looking for? And I want to eliminate every other thing that could be affecting those scores. So I think you do a good job of that. And I'm actually pretty happy with how things go. And I hope you guys are too. And if you're not, of course, or if you have suggestions like Battlefield 4 for us, we'd certainly love to talk about it in our new forums. So check us out at thehardwareasylum.com forums. And let us know what you think of benchmarking.
In the last segment, we talked about consistency in video card reviews and how monitor size and resolution plays a big part in that. I use a HP 30-inch for my video card testing, but Darren has a 27-inch that is close to that same resolution, and you just got a new one, right, from Mastrop,
I think? I did, yeah. So we've talked about Mastrop in the past. And one of the things that attracted me to it was the ability to purchase enthusiast-level hardware at a nice discount and a little ahead of the curve for price drops. So I will put a link in the show notes so you can check out Mastrop again if you haven't. But if you're curious, I had my previous build. Let's start there.
All right.
So I had a Dell UltraSharp 27-inch monitor, the U2715H for those of you spec hounds out there. A fantastic monitor, and I haven't had it for very long. That particular monitor, I think I paid, I don't know, $7 for.
Yeah. Well, the appeal there was 25 by 14.
Exactly.
For the screen resolution, so it's near 30-inch.
And, I mean, I don't know that I need to remind folks out there that are regular viewers, but my primary focus isn't so much overclocking as it is high-end gaming. You know, I love the overclocking aspect, but for me, a moderate overclock is enough as long as I can get maximum frame rate and no disadvantage. So for me, it was a really nice sweet spot for resolution. Got great draw distances. Of course, the color spectrum of the ultra-sharp monitor is phenomenal. The brightness, everything. Fantastic monitor. Love it. So why did I replace it is probably the right question.
Well, you wanted another one, right?
I did. So it's like this. I have also another Dell UltraSharp, a U2412M.
That's stinky.
Yeah, I've had for quite a while. In fact, I've had that monitor, I think, since it first came out. And again, another phenomenal Dell monitor, as all UltraSharps are.
Yep. It's not necessarily the brand Dell. It's mm-hmm. the panel that's inside it. And that's what you need to, when you're spec hunting for a monitor, look at the panel, not necessarily who makes it.
Well, I think it's no secret out there. Maybe you could call it rumor, but it's widely accepted that Dell tends to get the pick of the crop, especially for their ultra-sharp and business-level monitors. So you're getting maybe the best possible panels out there. At least we think they're cherry-picked, and they seem to be. It all sounds good.
Yeah, the HP monitors that I use are using the same panel that the ultra-sharps use. Mm-hmm. It's just they aren't branded ultra-sharp.
So not to be too snobby, of course, but you know, you don't want to mess around. You're going to have a monitor usually through multiple builds, and that is normally the case for me as well. But I had the opportunity to pick up this ultra-wide monitor. So I picked up, thanks to MassDrop, a LG 34UM94P. That's all kind of a nice mouthful for 34-inch class ultra-wide monitor, and that's a 21.9 widescreen aspect.
Yeah, that's basically two 24s stuck together.
Yeah, maybe a little bit bigger, but you know, for me as a gamer, the appeal was I get the same double screen that I like, but there's no bezel in the middle. And as another nice advantage, because I'm always looking for the best bang for my hardware buck, it doesn't require as much critical hardware to drive as your 30-inch or the 4K monitors that people are so excited about.
Yeah, it's because it's all based off of vertical resolution.
That's right. And I think you need to understand that the price point on these things is phenomenally dropping. Now, I got the Class Edition, and its resolution is 3440 by 1440, which is, I mean, fantastic. I mean, you could maybe even say it's a 4K monitor without stretching the truth too badly.
Well, if you count the pixels, I believe it is. Now, I think you mentioned this, but it's not the curved one, right?
No, it's not. In fact, I wasn't really sure that I wanted the curved one. Some people are probably going, what? Blasphemy. But remember that it's another maybe $200, $250 to get the exact same screen curved. And of course, that has to do with yields and the difficulty of making a good curved monitor. But I just didn't feel like it was important when I've got a monitor that wide sitting, you know, 3 feet or so in front of my face. So my entire field of view is taken up without having to worry about the curving. Some people that sit further back, maybe you could argue that. But my thought was I could take that extra money and put it into some other stuff. So I bought a Ergotech Dual 320 monitor arm. And what this is a really nice counterbalanced monitor arm that is conservatively rated if you're looking at the specs, but it's pretty easy to find examples of them holding monitors up to about 25 pounds. So I've got about 19 pounds in that ultra wide because they make them lighter and smaller every year. And so I'm going to be honest, maybe it's a little bit wishful thinking, but I thought maybe I could put that LG 34 and my Dell 27 together on the desk. And for you folks at home, I did.
So if I remember correctly from what you talked about, you put the 27 above the 34.
Right. So I'll get a picture of this for you guys to put in the show notes or in the forum, but visualize if you can. I've got the 34-inch ultra-wide, and it's great. My field of vision puts my eyeline just a little above halfway, which is about where I like it. Some people prefer a little below halfway, but I'm tall, so I'm used to being a little high. And then I put the 27-inch above it, and it looks fantastic except for one major problem, Dennis.
You got to reach your neck up?
Oh, yeah. It's a massive, massive height difference.
Yeah.
Which you'll show in the picture, but that's not even the problem. The problem is that that monitor stand is not really rated for 27-inch monitors and 24-inch ultra-wides, although it works on them. But what happens is putting that 27 monitor up above means that the bottom inch and a half of that screen is blocked. Dang it.
Oh, well, that sucks.
Let me tell you, if you think about it, you do not realize how often you use the bottom of the screen. Especially if you got a game running full speed in your bottom monitor, your top monitor, you need to be able to see what's going on your start menu, on the bottom of your browser, all kinds of stuff's down there, and it's just gone. The reality is, it really was wishful thinking. It doesn't fit.
Yeah. Before we get into the actual gameplay on this 34-inch,
yes,
let's talk about desktop usage. Because,
okay.
So the monitor arm, let's get to the monitor arm first.
Okay, the monitor arm. Fantastic, by the way, and a great deal. I think I paid less than $120 shipped.
That's not bad. And that connects to the VESA mount on the back of the monitor, correct?
It does, and it will mount on the back. Like in mine, I latched it down to the top of my desk, but it also has the ability to strip through it, although I think that the 320 does not allow you to wall mount, so you'd be looking at a different product.
Okay, gotcha. Hardware aside, I mean, that's just like hanging an LCD in your living room or something.
Exactly.
Like that.
Although you have the ability to move it around, and the field of movement is really great. In fact, it gives me so much that I could literally take that 34 and stand it on end and it would still hold it up.
Nice. Very nice. Okay. So getting to the desktop aspect of it, we have, what is it, 3440 pixels wide, which is quite large.
Yes, indeed. Takes some getting used to.
Yeah. Now, when I first bought my 24s, because I have two 24s, 19 by 12 resolution, and I have those side by side, and that's basically my workstation desktop.
Right.
When I first got those, I felt like I was watching tennis, going back and forth between the panels to get to the edges.
Yes.
I believe with your monitor, you probably have the same thing.
A little bit. Now, of course, the nice advantage of having a really good gaming mouse is you can change the acceleration. So I have my acceleration probably a little bit higher than most folks.
Yeah, so you can get back and forth.
Yes.
And so I tend to move all of my stuff toward the middle bezel so that I can see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just put all the other things on the peripheral. Now, on your particular monitor, do you happen to put everything in the orthodoxic...
the side-by-side?
Side-by-side, or do you kind of group everything in the middle?
Well, a couple things about that monitor. One of the most important things about it, and in fact, one of the reasons that I was attracted to it, having not been an LG fan before, although they have a great reputation...
LG's good.
Yeah, is it has the ability to run two separate inputs simultaneously side by side. So it will actually work, if you want, as two separate monitors for two different inputs.
Not bad.
Which is handy for me because I find myself occasionally working with a second PC. I have multiple PCs in the house. Or I might be, you know, doing tech work on some poor sucker's machine. And it's nice to have the ability to have the two up. So it could work as a single monitor, eliminating the need for two, which is nice. But I'm also running Windows 10, and this ability is also available in Windows 8 and further back if you want to mess with it. But I can drag it to the right, and boom, it immediately jumps to half screen right side, and drag one to the left, and boom, jumps to half screen left side, which gives me, like we mentioned, roughly the same equivalent as two 24-inch monitors.
Cool.
And that gives me great side-by-side. Now, one thing that I've become aware of is I've been looking to see what other people are doing is folks that code for a living,
like me,
like to turn these things vertical and use one to view an insane amount of code or lines. And you can actually, believe it or not, you could put two monitors on the right side if you had a dual 320 arm like I do, and a third one. So if you're thinking about it, it would actually look like, you know, a U set on its side with the three monitors. And I've seen this out there, and I have to admit, I'm a little bit jealous because it looks awesome, but I don't have the need.
Yeah, that's going to be really tall. I mean, I liked being able to read code. You know, I code. I do a lot of web programming and stuff like that. And you can have some pretty long scripts to go and do just mundane tasks. At some of my day jobs, we had a 30-inch monitor right in front of us, and then off to the side, we had a 24 that we turned up on side. And that's where we ran our code or our browser or something like that. And then we had all of the other things in the middle. So I can see the need, but at 34 inches tall, that's really looking up to see what's going on.
Well, and certainly a monitor of this level is probably overkill. You can get a really great 34 or 29-inch ultra-wide monitor with a lower resolution, maybe not a class level, for way less money than I spent. And I would certainly recommend looking into that, especially if you're on a budget. I think I would have just been as impressed with a 29-inch wide that would have been half the price.
Right.
But, you know, it's a little bit about future-proofing. But I didn't buy it for coding, Dennis. I bought it for gaming.
Yeah, and that's the part that we're going to transition into once we got the desktop stuff out of the way, because that's boring.
Oh, yes, yeah, so the work. Gorgeous monitor, great stand, no longer needing it. And, of course, it requires DisplayPort to really work. If I were to pick a negative, I should cover this before we move on, it would be that the refresh rate is at about 60.
And, oh, yeah, it's locked.
And it's locked. So you get plus or minus a tiny bit there. But the nice thing is using the DisplayPort and the G-Sync, you're going to really maximize that 60 pretty much all the time.
Well, that's what it's designed for.
Yes, exactly. So no complaints there. But so, let's talk gaming.
Yeah. Back in the day.
Okay.
I remember Quake 3. You could change the field of view and basically make what you saw bigger.
Well, yeah.
Can you do that with the widescreen? How does the picture translate?
I want to plug a couple of sites because I did a lot of research. I was worried, and I was looking at 4K monitors and not sure I wanted to put the expense into it. Now, I should point out that I run a 970 video card, and it's a super clocked card, and it's fantastic. What I would just, I would call it the sweet spot, but I wasn't certain it was going to give me max on a 4K monitor, and you don't have to worry about that on an ultra wide. As you already mentioned, you know, most of that driving is the vertical.
Yeah, the vertical.
So yeah, you're going to see a little bit of a performance hit on the horizontal, but I have no problem driving that thing at max or near max resolution on everything that I've tried. In fact, the only thing that I ever worry about is draw distance.
Well, and that's CPU horsepower, not necessarily GPU.
Yes, and you know, as some of you know, we're working on a build that will resolve that now, but I'm on a 3770K, which is a phenomenal processor, but it is starting to show its age a little bit.
All right. So if I remember correctly, you needed to run a couple of tools to get the resolution right.
Right. So I want to plug the site that I spent a lot of time on is WSGF.org, which is the Widescreen Gaming Forum. And I'll admit just in public here that I'm a bit of a voyager. I don't think I've done anything but look at that puppy. I haven't posted for sure. But it has a great, great forum. It talks about how to get things to work in widescreen. And I also found a fantastic app that I want to plug too. So I will. It's called Flawless Widescreen. Flawlesswidescreen.org is the site. And what it is a little front end that reminds me a lot of the Razer Cortex. Is that what it is, front end? Or Steam, in that you can run this thing, and what it'll do is it'll launch your games for you in a native widescreen resolution if they're supported. It has a terrific list of games. And ironically, I primarily play just a couple of different games, and I dabble in others, but I play Battlefield 4, which we've already talked about. I don't benchmark in it, but I do play it probably more than anything lately.
And that game doesn't natively support ultra widescreen.
It doesn't. And although Flawless Widescreen doesn't say that it has settings for it, it does.
Oh, cool.
So I used that to do the initial setup, and I'll be honest, I looked at how it set things up, and now I launch without it because I'm a little nervous about the, you know, the app taking some precious cycles away from me.
Ooh.
But it works fantastic. And then I play Dying Light, which until very recently didn't support ultra-wide.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about it. But I can also run, dun-dun-dun, Civilization ultra-wide.
Nice.
There's something cool about seeing an insanely gigantic map.
Yeah, so when it runs in ultra-wide, does it increase the field of view, or does it crop it, or how does that actually interact there?
No, Battlefield 4 is a great example. Battlefield 4 actually extends your draw vision, which gives you really fantastic peripheral vision. In fact, it can be distracting initially, at least I thought it was, because you're just not used to things moving that far to your left and right in your screen.
Yeah.
So I found myself jerking to see stuff, and of course, I'm running at a fairly high resolution, so I got all kinds of environmental effects and stuff blowing in the wind and all that cool stuff that if I were playing competitive, I would turn off. But, you know, that eye candy is really what I buy the hardware for.
Right.
So it's not unusual to be on an outdoor map and have something blow by your field of vision and turn to see what the heck it is and expect to shoot something, which is honestly amazingly cool. So what it does is it gives you the ability to see things out of your corner of your eye like you would in real life. Now, I imagine myself as a rockin' super military soldier, and nothing surprises me from the sides anymore. And I have the jump on a lot of folks when I come around corners.
Does it distort the picture?
Not at all. In fact, it looks fantastic. I don't find any picture quality difference. Now, I ran some default, picture optimization stuff on it when I got it, but it looks fantastic. I don't see any quality difference.
Okay.
The only possible downside is maybe a tiny bit of black fade that I didn't have on my Ultra Sharp, but you just don't notice it when you're playing games.
Oh, cool. So yeah, a lot of times when, like the stereoscopic goggles that you can wear now, they will go and distort the sides to make it look stretched.
Oh yeah.
Because that is how your peripheral vision kind of stretches that when you look off to the side.
Yeah.
A lot of, like in Quake 3, for instance, when you could increase the field of view, it actually would do that as well. So it made it look like it was really the corner of your eye. Now, it doesn't do that on your ultra wide.
Oh, no. And in fact, it's funny they say that because a lot of folks have that problem when they're running projectors and they have to go in and tweak them to get that nice square picture. And so that's a better example for the folks at home that are trying to visualize this effect. When you first set up a monitor and it looks sort of hourglass or reverse hourglass,
yeah,
it's the same sort of effect, and you can fix that generally through your projector. But this one's doing it natively, and a lot of that is, of course, built into the driver support. But a lot of it is also making sure that you have the correct setting set up, and that's where something like flawless widescreen comes in.
Cool. So that's going to be almost a must for playing games on the ultra-wide, at least until some of the new games support the resolution.
Absolutely. Natively. Well, you're just, you know, it's a new technology, and I remember when 4K first came out, everybody was gaga about 4K, and let's be honest, there just isn't a lot of 4K content, and there maybe won't be for a while. And even maybe more honest is it just requires so much more money to drive it in a satisfactory way. And what's the good of 4K if you're going to have tearing or slowdown or any of those issues? It's just not worth it. And I just didn't want to put out for a couple of 980 video cards. I mean, that's the same cost as the monitor.
Yeah.
So I bought this, and I gotta tell you, I'm starting to believe that widescreen gaming might actually be the future, not 4K, at least in the short run.
I could agree with you there. And this might be where we see a change or like a diversion. So we have 4K in the home theater, because I can see that as being a legitimate content.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe not streaming. It's going to have to be on a physical media. But then in, you know, in the gaming world, on the desktop, we have the ultra wides. And then for folks like me that actually code and work professionally, that's where the 4K might come in play.
Mm-hmm.
But only for the vertical resolution, because that's what's important when you're doing pictures or coding. It's like you need more vertical.
Well, absolutely. And don't forget that a lot of movies are filmed in ultra-wide formats. The 21.9 is not an unusual resolution to find. And so, I mean, especially when you're talking about videos and movies that are really pushing the cutting edge of graphics, they're going to be released in these higher resolutions, and they look fantastic. So I would encourage you, maybe you've been lusting over a 4K monitor, you might want to give the ultra-wide monitors a chance. Not only is it going to be easier to power, but it's going to be easier on your checkbook and maybe a little more versatile in the long run, too.
Yeah, and something to think about. What about ultra-wide in 3D?
You
know how the biggest issue with 3D is the fact that your peripheral vision always sees that hard edge and it really screws up the effect?
Yes.
Now we got 3D and you won't see the edges.
Well, I certainly am not a huge 3D fan, but
that might be the future.
That's going to give those little virtual reality glasses maybe a run for their money.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm now thinking it might be fun to stack two ultra wides in the future and see how that works out. But for now, I'm stuck with a 24 and a 34, and we'll just see how it works out. But check it out, folks, and let us know what you think in the forums.
For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes on hardwareasylum.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Hardware Asylum by subscribing to our RSS. Follow us on Google or like us on Facebook. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2015. Thanks for listening.